Yeah, after our interview yesterday, I began to think of the period of 1918 and early 1919 when the Officers Training Corps was disbanded. During the war, it was necessary to have 2 years, I think it was, in the Corps in order to qualify for your promotion from 1 year to another or to get your degree. There was some unrest after the armistice, and in fact there was one incident which was to my mind quite a serious incident, had rather lasting implications in two phases, one its effect on the COTC and the other the effect on student government and discipline by the Students' Council of the students of the university. Shortly after the armistice on November 11, 1918, I was horrified, and most students at the university were horrified to see that they had built a scarecrow on the top of the old science building and had hoisted up on it and dressed up a uniform as if it was a scarecrow. And when one considered at that time that every day brothers and friends were dying right and left in defense of Canada, the thought that they should defile a uniform in that way was revolting to everybody except those who did it. Nobody seemed to be able to find out who did it, and of course Clink and Company were not particularly concerned about it. Following that, there was another incident of which was a serious incident. We were on parade, I suppose about 150 strong, outside the Arts Building, which is the only stone building there at Fairview. It had been the new building for the Vancouver General Hospital, and we took it over before it was furnished as the main arts building. We were on parade when all of a sudden the whole parade was deluged from the third story with a fire hose into on all the men and knocked some of them over. Fortunately, it didn't hit me, but I said to myself, although I was quite lame and still in hospital, I hobbled up three flights of stairs to see if I could catch them. I thought as I went up, well now, they won't come down the stairs, they'll try either the fire escape, and then I suddenly remembered that there was a hatch into the library, which is on the third floor, and that they won't come down the obvious way, the fire escape, they'll go into the library and mix up with the students in there who are studying. So I went into the library and stood there, looked around for a while, and I saw a couple of fellows that didn't seem to have any books in their hands. I turned around and looked at their back, and their hands were absolutely black. And so I went up to them and said, "What's your name?" And they said, they gave them a name. And then I said, "Were you on the roof?" And of course they couldn't deny it, their hands were black. So I got their names and reported them. And they were up for trial before the Students' Council, which is a full trial in the auditorium. And that was the first trial, I think, disciplinary action taken by the Student Council of UPC. And they were convicted, and I really can't recall what the sentence was, but I think it was that they would not be allowed to get their degree with the other students, or they weren't barred their degree, as I recall it, but they were not to take part in the ceremonies and were censored in that way. So that established the principle that the student government had power over the students. And I think that was the first That's why I mentioned this thing. I think that may be the first major incident in the history of the university where the Students' Council really took action. They had their council, which were students, and I was, of course, the... I was also a student. I was a complainant on this case. And there was a great, really, break between those who favored the action these young vandals had taken and the others, many of whom had come back wounded or otherwise from the war, or who had brothers killed and that sort of thing. So it established the principle that student government, if properly administered, can handle the problems of the students. Now, I'm sure in the last 60 years there has been many other incidents where students have been up. Yes. But I thought it might be of interest to you to hear that story.
It is interesting. I wonder also, as you're describing these two events, do you think they sort of divided the campus too, divided the student body in opinion?
It did to some extent, and I'm afraid that many of these students who did these things, which were disgraceful, were not really bad people, but just misguided in their attitude. Of course, one can readily appreciate how you would feel to see a uniform of somebody who's your brother's uniform who had died in it, see it put up as a scarecrow. And undoubtedly it caused, but it may have been a good thing to have brought this to their attention, and especially I think it was a good thing that the whole of the student body were present when the court was held, just like an ordinary court. Mm-hmm. And of course then, shortly after the armistice, they had some troubles in Toronto University on this business of having COTC compulsory, and they folded. They said, no, we're not going to do anything. And of course, then Clink and Company had a great argument, and they folded. Now, that's when it went out of existence, I would say, about April 1919.
Yes.
I forgot that is my memory of quite a long time ago.
And then after that, it took about
ten years before it came back again. Then, you see, by that time, people that were thinking could see that the war to end all wars wasn't really ending it. By then, see, what time would that be? 1928, the resurgence of Germany was coming along a bit then, troubles in Europe. People who were studying it figured, well, maybe we'll have to fight again, as it turned out.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the early years of the war, after you left the Pacific Defense, the defense of the Fraser Valley, you went to Washington. And I wonder what was, you mentioned earlier that your role was in part procuring military equipment. Is this?
That's right.
Was this for supplying the Canadian Army?
For the Canadian Army, yes. And of course, as you know, the United States were not in the war at that time, and therefore it was a matter of some delicacy to get what we wanted and still keep within the law.
Yes. You dealt with the American Army directly, did you?
With the very American Army in its various phases, various branches of the American Army. And of course, as the military attaché there, your duties were primarily directed towards what was known as the branch of the staff in the American Army at that time was called G2, which was whose primary duties was intelligence. And therefore, as military attaché, we gathered as much intelligence as we could that would be helpful to the Americans and vice versa, and passed it back and forth.
Did you observe a difference in attitude between the U.S. Army and the official government position?
No, as far as I could gather, there was the greatest cooperation, but they felt, and I think quite rightly so, that it would have been premature for them to have gone into the war when the general public was still not, and quite understandably so, very much interested in another war in Europe. But as far as official Washington was concerned, they might just as well have been in the war. They didn't wear the men in the army wore their uniforms, but the other people were breaking the law right and left in favor of the Allies, as you know. Mm-hmm. The most cooperative, I never found anything but the greatest cooperation from all of them.
Did you observe some of the steps which would have led to the lend-lease policy written?
Well, that was really a matter between Great Britain and the United States. Under their legislation, it was impossible for them to give away these things, but they could loan them. Leased them, I think, under their law. So that was really the reason that the lend-lease thing started. In other words, I could loan you something provided I didn't give it to you.
After your post in Washington, you were appointed Adjutant General in Ottawa.
That's right. In February 1942, I was promoted from brigadier to major general and took over adjutant general, which is the second branch of the staff. And you want me to go on with
you?
There's the branch of the general staff, which is, and the chief of the general staff is the coordinator for all branches of the staff. He is primarily charged with plans, operations, and training. Then there's the adjutant general, whose primary duty is personnel, in the broadest sense of the term, discipline, recruitment, hospitalization, reinforcements, rehabilitation, and everything that has to do with personnel.
In this capacity, in this capacity, would have you then dealt directly with all the different militia units across the country, specifying the needs of the armed forces?
No, we didn't directly deal with them. We dealt through the various district officer commanding or area commands later on. There was a Pacific Command, Central Command, Eastern Command. We would deal with through their staff, and they in turn would deal with the...
I see.
That was the chain of command.
I see. I was wondering, until the middle of 1942, until Dieppe, the forces and Canadian forces, there wasn't really a great deal of pressure for recruitment, was there? Because there hadn't been any action, therefore need for replacements.
There hadn't been... The recruitment kept up very well, and at one time, well, several times during the early phase of the war, we shut down recruitment, and it wasn't until 1942 that we could see that there might be a problem.
What was the policy at that time regarding recruitment?
Well, it was a voluntary recruitment, and I really forget when the National Resources Mobilization Act came in, but it was sometime during that time when there was recruitment, then there was compulsory service for home service, for home defense. I think it was in the latter part of 42. I'd have to look it up. It's stupid that I can't remember the exact date.
Yeah, I believe 1940 the government at any rate held a plebiscite to release them from their previous pledge.
That's right.
Not to have any conscription.
Yeah. Well, that was for overseas service.
That's correct, yeah. And I believe in 1941 it was where they introduced conscription for home defense?
I think it was 41. You're quite right.
But the policy, anyway, until the Canadian forces were very deeply involved in the battles in Europe and Italy and France, was more one of, I'm just suggesting a term here, of preparedness, do you think, of being...
No, I think it was voluntary service. We always felt, and I felt, that if we could go on the voluntary principle, it was the best principle, because anybody that came in came of their own volition. But it's a very untidy way to do things.
Yes.
Because you never know how many men you're going to have, and you never know what action and how many men you're going to require when you're in action. You can estimate, and that's it.
Well, was your position on conscription, and when it later on became, when later on Mackenzie King did use forces for overseas service?
Well, it was an absolute necessity and had to be done. You can't allow your fellow soldiers to be fighting an enemy in a bitter struggle and not support them. And we had all these men in Canada trained, and it was unfortunate that there was this political issue, which is largely due to the Quebec situation. Actually, we only missed the boat so far as voluntary recruitment is concerned, not by the numbers we had volunteer, but we had them in the wrong packages. We had too many artillery, too many Army Service Corps, and too few infantry. Now that is a very fascinating problem as to how many of each category you train. It's dependent, first of all, on the severity of the action, whether you're going to be, that is, the periods you're in action and out of the line. It's depends on this, that's the time factor if you're in, whether the action is intense or whether it's ordinary or whether it's just no casualty type of thing. Then there's the question of recovery, how many men will go to hospital and how long they'll be in hospital before they can rejoin their unit. And there's the other thing is how fit will they be when they come out of hospital? Will they be frontline soldiers, or would they be able to do a job just as well as a fit man back of the line somewhere? So all these problems, then you have to figure out what is the enemy action going to be, how many, what percentage are going to be killed and wounded in the infantry, artillery, and that will depend, of course, largely on the type of warfare. If you have strafing from the air, the people in the backward, rearward lines are just as liable to be killed as those in the front line. Whereas if you have air superiority and the enemy are precluded from coming over your lines, the fellows that are going to have all the casualties are the fellows in the front. Now, it's interesting that after the Sicilian invasion, I questioned the rates that the British had worked out over a number of years. What percentage should go to infantry, what should go to artillery, and so on and so, when out of your training camps. I questioned that, and they said that I was wrong. I wrote another paper on it, which I'd give $1,000 if I had a copy of it, pointing out that I thought that I still thought that they were wrong, that they weren't putting enough into infantry. Well, as it turned out, I was quite right. We had all kinds of fellows over in other corps, but we were short in infantry. We only missed the boat by about 1%, but we shouldn't have missed it at all if we had been able to predict, and I'm not saying it's possible to predict, that we, instead of putting, say, 10% into Army Service Corps, we'd put 5% in there and put the other 5 into infantry. So at the end of the war, just before the conscription crisis came up, we were transferring people from one corps to another. The United States had the same problem. In fact, they took, General Marshall just went through the officers' training course and took them all and turned them all into infantry because they were short after, I think it was about the Battle of the Bulge time.
Oh. Which of those factors do you think was responsible for Canadian forces being short of the infantry? Why do you think the Canadian forces were short of infantry?
Well, because we didn't put enough in to train. Right. We put too many in. You have 1,000 men.
Yes.
And your army's made up of so much infantry, so much artillery, so much Army Service Corps, so much ordnance and so on. Well now, if you put them all in ordnance in the back there, you have nobody to fight in the front. If you put them all in the front, you have no ordnance to support them.
Yeah. But so this is still based upon the predictions of what kind of warfare would be fought. And I wonder, was it because of the campaigns in Italy?
The campaign in Italy did affect us to some extent, that you had two headquarters. I mean, you double up when you have two armies, one in France and one in England. The primary fault, in my opinion, was that we didn't put enough people in to train as infantry. And you can't take a fellow that's trained as artilleryman and throw him overnight to become an infantry. He's used to handling a big gun, whereas he doesn't necessarily know very much about handling the weapons of the infantry.
I was going to make the suggestion too that because in the latter years of the war, the Allies had almost complete control of the air, so that means all the rear operations wouldn't suffer hardly at all.
That's right.
So therefore, it would be the
which was quite contrary to what happened in the first of the war,
yes.
when the Germans had air superiority. It's a fascinating study and it's a typical example of how what do they call it, the fog of war, and that's all it is, because you can't predict accurately what's going on. And then our casualties were heavier, and the Canadian were involved in intense action for longer periods than had been predicted when these tables were made up. We took the British tables, and of course they suffered the same way, because they were particularly short of officers. So when our home defense divisions here were broken up or became unnecessary, we were able to give to the British on loan, which was called Can Loan, I forget how many hundred, 200 or 300 highly trained officers, many of whom reverted from being majors and in one case lieutenant colonels to lieutenants, to go when the invasion of France took place. They suffered very heavily, but no heavier casualties than would be expected of lieutenants. A lieutenant is the heaviest casualty rate of any platoon commanders, as a rule.
The Department of National Defense had a policy regarding COTC of encouraging students to stay in university until they graduated before they enlisted into the forces.
Yes.
I wonder if you were you aware at the time of that particular policy? Did you approve of it? That as soon as you get his education, also get his rank and qualification before he enlisted into the forces?
Well, we felt that, not knowing how long the war was going to last, that it was well for them to get their finish. I don't know that that was a firm policy, was it, that they had to finish their education?
No, it wasn't a compulsory kind of setup. It was just a government sort of encouragement. Say, do this, and you won't be called up for any service. As long as you take the compulsory military training on campus, then you will not be called up.
That's right.
And an official opinion is that you should be encouraged to continue and graduate first.
Yes, well, you get the best of two worlds then. You get an officer who has a good education and has also had his, during that time, has had his basic military training or beyond his basic military training. He's a qualified officer when he comes out.
Yes. How did you feel about dividing up the Canadian forces when they're overseas?
The principle of the Canadian forces. And now I'm talking to the Army. You're talking the Army only. As you know, the poor Air Force were scattered to the four winds of the earth. We resisted that policy in the first war, and I just divert for a moment on that. when Sir Sam Hughes was the Minister of National Defense, and when the first Canadian contingent went over, Kitchener said to him, well, yes, we'll take your men, and we'll put a battalion here and a battalion there, and we'll... And Sam Hughes, who was, to my mind, a great man, said, to hell with that, we're going to fight as a unit or not at all. We don't mind taking British officers who are trained to handle larger bodies of men than we have handled trained officers in Canada, but you're not going to break us up. And he won his battle with Kitchener, who was, I think, one of the stupidest men that ever happened. The Germans in the First War certainly did us a good turn when they sunk the Hampshire and down went Kitchener, because he was out of the way, as he blocked everything that was forward-looking. Sam Hughes said to him, and I got this straight from Sir Sam Hughes, because he happened to be on the train when I came back wounded, and I landed in St. John, New Brunswick. He was on the same train. He had me in every day for, day after day, for 3 days to talk to him. And I was only a lieutenant. And he'd say, what do you think of Sir Arthur Currie? I don't think he did right in this and that. And of course, as a young lieutenant of 19 or 20, you wouldn't think of speaking about the commander-in-chief. If I'd had a tape recorder like this there, I didn't need to work for the rest of my life, the stories he told me about South Africa. I must tell you one. It's nothing to do with COTC, but Sam Hughes came from Ontario, and he wanted to get out to the South African War. Canada sent two contingents, small contingents, to the South African War. And Sam wasn't very popular. He was a member of Parliament, I think. He wasn't very popular with the military authorities, and he couldn't get out. But eventually he got to South Africa and joined up with the Canadians as, I think he was a colonel then, lieutenant colonel. And what his capacity was, I'm not quite clear. But at any rate, he told me this story. He said, now I remember one day riding up to the front. He said, the bullets were flying around everywhere. And he said, I was wondering what to do when I saw way up front in the British lines and a young Highlander there. And he tied a white handkerchief to the bandit on his rifle and was waving it to the enemy. He said, I didn't know whether to draw my revolver from my holster and shoot him, but I thought of something else. And this is a true story. He said, I felt in my saddlebag and I pulled out a Union Jack I had there. And he said, I galloped up and I said to this boy, here, my boy, whenever you feel like that, tie this to your bayonet instead of that white flag. And he said, you know, that fella rose to be a major and won the Distinguished Service Order. Right. Now, whether it's a true story or not, but stories like that, they were just fantastic. And I believe it was a wonderful 3 days, that train trip from St. John's to Winnipeg.
Uh-huh. Well, Sam, he's quite adamant on the point of keeping the Canadian forces
there. Oh, yes. He won the battle there. We were talking about breaking up. And he won the battle there, and so we had no trouble about that.
You set a precedent then.
Hmm?
You set a precedent by doing
that. Oh, absolutely. Because the Canadians fought better as together than they did, as was evidenced in the First War. We had the division and then the Canadian Corps. And we won our battle there. But the division of the Canadian troops was this. There are various factors that entered into it, political and otherwise. Because we'd been in England since 39, December 39, and it was now on to 43, I guess it was, and they hadn't been in action except for the Dieppe raid. And our senior officers had had no experience whatever in battle handling brigades, divisions, corps. And it was felt that it would be very imprudent to trust anyone of them with a Canadian corps as such going into battle for the first time when none of them had been blooded. Consequently, they sent a number of officers to North Africa, junior officers, for training, but it still was felt that we should have, as you know, it was bitterly opposed by General McNaught. I had the unhappy task of carrying the message to him in England at his headquarters that it had been decided that 1st Division would go to Italy. And he said to me, I remember as if it were yesterday, some things were clear in my mind. He said, you and Ken Stewart was the chief of the general staff. He was my senior, of course. And he said, you and Ken Stewart will be responsible for returning us to colonial status again if you do this. And he was ill then. I mean, he had flu, I knew, and all that. But he was very bitter about the whole thing. Unreasonably so, in my opinion.
The Canadians stayed on in Italy for a long time after that.
Yeah, then we sent out another division.
Yeah, 5th Armored was added to the force in Italy.
And then they joined up, of course, finally in Europe, much to Lord Alexander's sorrow that he was losing the Canadians, whom he was commander-in-chief in the Mediterranean. But he quite agreed that they should go. He always agreed the Canadians should fight as a unit, but that was our only thought, was that they should fight as a unit, but that they should go in with a chance of experienced officers who had had experience handling troops in battle. Not the junior officers particularly, but the senior officers, battalion and brigade and divisional commanders.
Would you say that the experiences in Italy then did add up for the whole Canadian Army, so that when they were fighting in France, there was experience to draw upon, which would have helped them in their campaigns?
Oh, definitely. No question about that, in my opinion.
So you were also, do you think you were sacrificing some autonomy, though, by joining one part of the Canadian Army to the British 8th Army, in that sense, and therefore under the command of...
Well, we were always under the command of a higher formation. I mean, we, the army groups, you see. No, I don't think we sacrificed any autonomy at all, because we were finally joined up for the final episodes. And we couldn't have had, the whole of the Corps, I don't think, could have gone in at the landing. I don't think they would have put them all in at the landing anyhow. So I think it worked out all right. It did stretch our reinforcing pools a bit. If you have two reinforcing pools, one in England, one in Italy, working at the same time, it does take a staff for each. So it was a bit, in that case, in that respect, it did put a strain that would not have occurred had we been one unit entirely.
I know we're keeping on a topic that isn't completely related to COTC. What do you think were, as you had some personal contact with General McNaught, what do you think was the real meaning of his phrase that Canada was becoming more of a colony?
Well, he said reverting to colonial status. In other words, that we're breaking up our army and putting it under British command. Well, it was going to be under British command anyhow, because we could.
But the chain of command was broken, though, because it would be the British and then the overall Canadian commander and then all the Canadian forces. Whereas in this case, it was the British who had command over one part of the Canadian army, which would have superseded the Canadian control over that one.
Well, no, it didn't. It never did. Theoretically, the commander of the Canadian troops anywhere has direct access to Canada, and he can refuse if he so chooses. any order that he feels is not is detrimental to the safety of his command. That was always included in any orders that attached troops to the British or to any other formation.
We move on to after, in 1944 to 46, you return to Washington.
Yes.
This is in what capacity does the...
Chief of the military mission. There was a... I was a senior, I was a major general. There was a rear admiral and an air vice marshal. Those were the three heads of the three services. And our job was to liaise with the combined chiefs of staff and to keep Ottawa informed as to what the plans were for the future and what and the present. And of course, as the war came to a conclusion, to work with the Americans in the formation of the Pacific Force, which never, of course, was utilized, and to work out whether we'd go on British war establishments or whether we'd go on the American table of organization, as to whether we would have our own line of communication regarding supplies, ammunition, and so forth, whether we adopt American weapons, and that was the problem, one of the big problems I dealt with when I was there for that time, towards the end. But it was mostly keeping Ottawa informed and keeping in touch with the whole situation.
I wonder if you felt, in view of the tremendous power that the United States commanded, tremendous military power by staging the war, did you feel that there was always a harmonious relationship between the Canadian and the American forces in this way? Was there any assumption on the part of the American forces of, how can I put this, that somehow the Canadian forces should pretty well follow whatever the American forces do because of their...
No, I don't, I didn't sense that at all. General Marshall, who was chief of the general staff and senior commander, was always meticulous about such matters. And there were occasions where they made decisions, undoubtedly, forgetting about Canada. Decisions which did affect us. But once it was drawn to their attention, they, especially on the higher level, never did anything deliberate.
It was really then from lack of complete information about a decision rather than...
Well, yes, rather that. And when you consider we had our forces in size compared to the tremendous forces they had, and the fact that they were fighting two wars at once, one in the Pacific and one in Europe, I think... My experience, at any rate, was that they never presumed to order us around in any way. On the other hand, sometimes the British were a little bit inclined, some of their senior officers, to think that we were part of their outfit. And I can remember one or two instances
Can you recall them?
Yes, I can recall them. I forget his name now, but it doesn't matter. We had a battalion in Jamaica doing guard duty in Jamaica one time. And there was a flare-up between British Honduras and Honduras, which has been going on for 100 years. And to my horror and amazement, I got a call from this officer. He said, I've told my brigadier that your battalion will be ready to go to Honduras. I said, the hell you have. I said, you have no command over him any more than you have over me. And I said, I'm informing Ottawa on the phone just right now. Oh, he said, you're not going to do that. I said, you're damn right I am. And he was a good friend of mine. McCready was his name. Well, he said, I said, those troops are sent to Jamaica and they cannot be sent anywhere else without the authority of the Canadian government. Oh, he said, is that so? Well, I said, yes, you knew that too, Gordon. I said, you knew it, you knew it. So that was good. But the Americans never tried any of that stuff because they knew better than that.
Yeah.
This isn't for publication, I suppose, but even if it was, I wouldn't mind. That's the true story.
Yeah.
He said, you're not going to tell Ottawa, are you? And I said, yes, I am. And I told him in 5 minutes, I went to the phone and called Murchie, who was then chief of staff, and I said, this is, he said, you did quite right.
Yeah. Yeah. Until after the war then, until 1952, you were secretary to the Governor General.
That's right.
And then after that, you were on a commission for the reorganization of the militia.
That's right. We traveled all over Canada and studied the, there's been so many forms of militia since the early days of the French regime and 1660 or whatever it was. In fact, our Canadian army antedates Cromwell's army, you know.
Really?
Well, if you count the
French
regime.
Yeah.
And so they've been organized in various forms, and every minister that comes along always thinks he has a better idea. Maybe it's a good idea. And everybody says, well, this will be the last reorganization. Well, it wasn't 5 years after our report that there was another report came in, and it reorganized, and after that there was another. And then came along Hellyer with his grandiose scheme of mucking up the whole works, which he did.
In your report, what were your major proposals? Your report would come out in 1955?
Yes. Well, it's very difficult to say what our major proposals were. Our major proposals were that there should be a regular army and the militia, more or less on the scale it was prior to the war, so that the units, instead of having too many units, that we would have enough units to look after the needs of the various localities. And that was a difficult task, because some units had to be disbanded, and it's always a heartbreak for those who are served in a unit to have it broken up. For instance, you take here, there was a unit, the Irish Fusiliers, which was a good unit, but it hadn't had a war history behind it either in the First or Second War. Although it had sent many, many men from its ranks, it had never served. So we felt that there were sufficient infantry units in Vancouver, for instance, to leave them just as they were. In other places, we stood down units, and now some other places we instituted a new unit, not many.
Mm-hmm. Was there a general trend, though, towards consolidation?
Yes. And to give more responsibility to grouping of the units. To go back to what we had here in Vancouver, more or less, before the war, a Vancouver group, you see, with a group commander and its own commander. Well, they've pretty well reverted to that now. You have here a militia area, and you have a militia colonel, and so forth.
Was there any, and you still saw the COTC, as being a major source of officer supply?
We did, and we could never figure out. The COTC sent a fair proportion to the regular army in the ROTP phase of it, but it never did, in the post-war years, it never seemed to attract many officers to the COTC, graduates of the COTC, to the militia. And I think that was one of the reasons that the regular army were able to say with some authority, well, what's the use of keeping this up? They're not going into the militia. But I always said, well, even if they don't go into the militia, they still have had the training. The same as prior to the war, and even now, And the RMC, the Royal Military College, at one time, there were only three vacancies out of each class that could go to the regular army, and the rest could go to the militia. And some didn't have any vacancies in the militia, so they were just out. But when the war came, they were trained officers, they joined up and they were there. So I said, for the money involved, I think it was a very short-sighted policy.
Yes. The squeeze on the COTC began in the late 50s.
Yeah.
One of the reasons was that, as you brought up already, that the Army complained that there wasn't enough graduates going into the militia.
Yeah.
But with ROTC, which was instituted in the early 50s, it was compulsory. Therefore, it was easy to see that the ROTC was paying off in terms of bringing in officers, but not the COTC.
Yeah, well, they had to in the ROTC because they paid their fees and everything else.
Yeah. Do you think there was also a direction, too, in the post-war period of armies requiring really less manpower, but more specialized people?
Yes, I think that's a fair observation.
For the Western nations, moving away from mass armies.
Yes, that's true. But you see, our army now and our armed forces are very low in regard to our population. If you compare the armed forces of other nations, I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but I think we're on the low side. I think before the war, our regular army was the lowest per capita in the world, except one place. I think it was Guatemala, I think. That's true. We only had 3,000, you know, I think, altogether in our armed forces before the war.
What did you think of integration when it started to come about?
Well, I'm very opposed to it in its present form. I think that there were certain things that were underway and could have been proceeded with that would have reached the same objective of doing away with overlapping and wastefulness. For instance, shall we take an example of the pay services? I don't think it matters too much where you get your pay from, so that there could be one pay corps, the same as possibly the chaplain services. I don't think it matters of religion, whether you wear a Navy uniform or it's too important. But so far as putting sailors in these green jumpers, taking away their, it's absolutely ludicrous, because a sailor has that tradition that he wants to be a sailor, and all other navies are different. So Hellyer, the big brain, thought that Corporal Hellyer of the Air Force thought he could do something that no other nation in the world has been able to do. And I think it'll take another 30 years to eradicate the damage he's done. It's gradually working out that way, though. Everybody wants to be distinctive to some extent, no matter whether you're in civilian life or business life or anything else.
You're emphasizing mainly the psychological effect.
That's right. After all, in armed forces, what was it Napoleon said? The moral is to the physical is 3-1. In other words, the will to fight and the pride in the unit, the pride in not letting the side down. It's something like a baseball team, a football team, rowing outfit, or anything you like. And that was destroyed to a large extent by this trying to make them all one. I'm all for saving, I'm all for cooperation. And we were doing it. I can give you an example. In Washington, when I went there as head of the mission, we were granted, I think, two cars and drivers for the Army, two cars and drivers for the Air Force, and two cars and drivers for the Navy. So that was six cars. And we used to, our officers were on one side of the Potomac and the Pentagon was in the other, and we'd often get calls to go back and forth. And our taxi bills, even with the six cars, were getting pretty high. And yet, the Army would go out and there'd be two Navy cars and two Air Force cars sitting there, but they couldn't use them. We'd have to get a taxi. So I suggested, I said, why don't we make a pool out of this thing? And the Navy fellow said, fine. And the Air Force fellow said, fine, but who are you going to get to run it? I said, I don't give a damn who you get to run it, what staff sergeant you have. And they said, well, I said, get a Navy. Oh, no, the Air Force said, no. And I said, get an Air Force fellow. And the Navy said, no. So they said, but we will agree if you give us your staff sergeant. My driver has a mission to run it. I said, all right, I'll just take somebody else to drive me around. I don't give a damn. And so he ran it, we pulled the cars, and the taxi bill was over. Now that's the sort of thing that can be done by cooperation. And it's, that phase of it is working out well now. And there's lots of things that have worked out well. But to go, he went too far, too quickly, in my opinion, by making them all wear the same uniform. When you've had a tradition, we'll say, of Navy or Merchant Marine for generations in your family, you don't want to get into an Army uniform or an Air Force uniform or the same as the Army or the Air Force. You want to be a little distinctive. That's where I think he destroyed more than he gained. And then he said he was going to save a lot of money on uniforms. Well, of course, that's all nonsense. The amount of money they spent to re-uniform the whole outfit, I'm sure it cost more than the thousands of old uniforms they had kicking around.
In the 1960s, you were a civilian.
Yes, 1960. Yes, that's right.
You were a resident in Ottawa.
Yeah,
your home now.
Yes, that's right. And I was president of the Dominican Canada Rifle Association and continued my interests as I do today in that respect.
Do you remember what your reaction was when you heard that they were considering disbanding the COTC?
Yes, I do. Very strong reaction I had was that it was a very short-sighted policy. I agreed, and nobody could refute the fact that they were not getting into the militia the officers they wanted, and I couldn't understand it, why they didn't get the officers they wanted. I don't understand it yet. But I still felt that the COTC should be kept up for those who wanted it. I didn't want it to be compulsory by any means. I hate the compulsory idea. But even if they didn't join, they had that training. And I thought it made better citizens of the lads. It made them available if it was necessary for a war to come. But here was an educated man who should be an officer. He hadn't had any training. He'd likely have to be drafted into something else, you see, right away. All his education, his training as a leader is gone.
Do you think you're getting to the point, though, that because the Army was, armed forces in the future were going to be less large and the positions probably more specialized, that there would be, you could foresee possibly less need to draw from the civilian ranks, even people who were previously had some officers training in the present day than in previous?
I don't think that was a factor. I think it was really the, as it always is, so far as the armed forces in Canada and Great Britain and elsewhere is concerned, they're faced with so many demands and with rising costs of equipment. To keep the equipment up to date, where are you going to get the money? The politicians give you so much money. How are you going to spend it? Well, they have to spend it as they see to the best advantage. And if they see no immediate response to the money that's been spent on COTC, somebody says, well, why not do away with them and we'll say whatever it was. It wasn't a big sum of money, you know, compared to the budget. And that's why I say, I think the fairest term would be to say it was, in my opinion, a short-sighted policy.
Do you know that the quota in the last years of the COTC at UBC that was set by Ottawa was 15? Very, very small compared to the previous one.
For ROTC?
For COTC. Mind you, ROTC was on, in addition to that.
Well, there's no COTC now.
I know. I'm referring to 1967-68, the last year. I was just pointing this out.
15.
It was reduced that far, yes.
Oh, yeah.
I wondered if in an unofficial capacity you spoke to people or corresponded with people when they're thinking, when they're trying to disband the COTC, trying to persuade people who you knew personally to reconsider the decision.
Oh, I did, yes, as far as I was talking to the chaps that I knew on the staff in Ottawa. And the fellow that knows more about it than anybody is President Mackenzie, because it was during his time, and he was very, very opposed to this. He asked me what I thought of it, and I agreed with him entirely that it was a short-sighted policy. And I think you'd find that he could tell you quite a lot about what went on then. I wasn't personally involved in it, naturally, because although I was next commanding officer, I did what I could indirectly to. But I knew that once these decisions are made, it's pretty hard to change them.
Did you speak to anyone in the armed services?
Oh, yes. I spoke to a number of people about it.
Did you speak to any politicians?
No. I keep clear of that.